This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most. Thank you all. I just love that we're one family here, sitting now over 1,000 shows. Wow. Thanks to the Patreons, the listeners around the world, and all these different countries. We have an international show today. She is a longtime friend of mine from, I don't know how many years, but I've admired her work for a couple decades now. Just incredible reporter, journalist, broadcaster in Norway for the Norwegian broadcast system. And it's just an honor to finally welcome to the family my dear friend Charlotte Berglof. Thank you for finally coming on.
Thank you so much for inviting me. The honor is all mine.
Did you get the gifts and everything that we sent every guest, the car and all that? Has it arrived yet, or has it been held up in Norwegian customs?
Held up in Norwegian customs, for sure. Yeah.
Okay. We'll make sure. You know what? I've always wondered, as I followed your career, how did you ever get so deeply embedded in journalism? I met you and we were doing yoga. How did your passion translate to this career and take you all over the world?
Well, as a child, I wanted to become an actress. And I was working hard for that. But then I think at the age of 13 or something, I admired that profession a lot. I know it's blood, sweat and tears. But then at the same time, I was it was kind of... everything around me, the society, the politics, what was going on in the life around me and in the world was catching my attention. I've always felt like a global kid in a global world. And I thought, no, it's journalism. And I felt this kind of call that this was my path. And I decided to, as soon as I finished high school, I decided to apply and go and study journalism in England. So I moved to England when I was 18 years old.
The work has taken you all around. And recently you were at the Polish border dealing with the refugees. You sent me some amazing pictures. What was that experience like for you firsthand to see really a modern crisis, people fleeing genocide, war in the modern age? That had to be deeply moving. I was moved looking at the photos you sent me.
Yeah, it was a very different experience this time because I've traveled on many continents covering many wars. And I've often covered like the hidden and forgotten conflicts that I care deeply about. So I've met a lot of people who are struggling with traumas from war, especially from Syria. From different parts, from Thailand, southern Thailand, from Angola. And what was very different this time was that we had a situation where the politicians in Europe, it was like politics on speed. That's what the Danish, former Danish prime minister, that's how he phrased it. It was like politics on speed. There were so many decisions being made in such a short time. So meeting the people who actually came crossing the border, I was standing at the border in Poland just a few days after the war broke out. And these people were welcomed. And they were welcomed warmly by the local people. And they kept pouring in. It was so many people coming. And these were the people who were coming in the beginning, so they hadn't really seen the war, many of them, but they were traumatized by the fact that they had to leave their loved ones. You know, you had separation between wives and their husbands and the children. It's a huge, an expert I spoke to, she called it, it's a mass production of trauma and, you know, what's been going on in the weeks that passed. But the change this time, which was very special, was that due to these politics and speed, all these people were given the right to come to Europe and to get the protection needed that refugees do need. And that changed something. And the whole mentality and the whole atmosphere was very different from, for example, the refugee crisis in Europe in 2015, when Syrians were fleeing and other people from the Middle East. came crossing into Europe, it was a very different atmosphere. So I think what I felt was that I think it's something in humans that if you are being given the ability to help someone in need, you will help. It's something in us. It's a solidarity. It's an act of love towards the unknown. And I think that that was what we were seeing, because the people in Poland, and in, I was also in Slovakia, they did everything to help. And it was deeply moving also for themselves to see what they were capable of and how they could help each other. Because, of course, this is shocking for everyone. This is shocking for anyone living in Europe, what we are dealing with at the moment.
Were you surprised at how quickly the governments came together and countries that were long time very neutral, like Switzerland, joined in the condemnation and boycotting and sanctions? And now you have Sweden and Finland considering joining NATO. Has that surprised you, given your background?
Absolutely. I remember from the genocide in Rwanda, you know, the UN taking so much time discussing, is it a genocide? Is it not a genocide? What is the term and what should we do? Here we had a completely different situation. We had politicians, and I think this is also maybe due to the pandemic, that they were used to having to make decisions very fast. And so we saw that in the first few days, you know, the after the war broke out, there were so many news coming in. I was sitting at the news desk during the first few days. And, you know, they were like, we were bombarded with big breaking news from almost any country in Europe who were making big decisions, whether it was weapons, whether they were going to contribute with that, or whether they were going to give protection to the refugees. There were so many decisions being made in such a short time. So we were amazed by the ability to make those decisions. But I mean, we won't know how these decisions will come into play and on the long term, what the effects will be. It's the same as during the pandemic. There were many decisions made in a very short time period, which we might not know or get the answer to in maybe 10, 20 years. What was the right thing to do? What should we have done differently? And I think that's the same case now. But what's becoming evident is what we are standing up against. And I think for a lot of people that Russia has kind of its face off. Now we know who Russia is or want to be, or Russia as in Putin's Russia. We don't, you know, for Russians, the force of fear is so large in Russia now that what people might think or feel is hard to know, but what Putin wants and his ideology and the course he's taken the country, I think that's becoming much more evident to people. And I think also that for those of us in journalism who've been tracking all these disinformation campaigns for years and who've been kind of struggling with conspiracy theories and rabbit holes and trying to kind of warn the public discourse, that there are forces that are maybe not that don't want democracy. They because I get a lot of hate mail, and I normally go into dialogue with the people writing to me to kind of figure out what are you really struggling with, or why are you so frustrated, what's the root cause of this. And often you can track it back to their personal situation, and you also track it back to some disinformation campaign that they've read through social media. So I think all of those aspects are interesting, and it's becoming more evident. It's more up in the it's more transparent for more people, I hope.
Were you shocked like I was that Putin even invaded? It just seems like such a dumb move, and now the world's united against him and all the bloodshed for no reason. Here he is as an older guy. I'm amazed that one lunatic who has such tight control over his country and has nuclear weapons can just create suffering for millions and millions of people. I just don't see the point in it. And now he probably thought he'd win in 3 days, and it's going on for months and it's a quagmire. And but what a waste. Were you caught off guard that they actually did it?
We were trying to understand what was going on, because he was having all these meetings in the days ahead that were quite strange. You probably remember this long marble table. He was at one end and you saw Macron at the other end. And then suddenly one day he had this meeting at a different very long table. but it was with his foreign minister, Lavrov. And I thought, why is he having this kind of meeting with Lavrov being broadcasted to all of us? What's he trying to tell us? Because I assume that they have meetings all the time, meetings that we don't get any broadcasts from. So what's the point in this? And in that meeting, they were kind of saying there is still a chance of dialogue. So that was kind of what the West were picking up on, and the UN and the UN General Secretary, he was saying, you know, we have to choose the path of dialogue. As you say, I mean, war is always the worst solution. It's always civilians being killed. It's the worst use of power by human nature, by humans. But I think that what, like the last 20 years, and especially the last few years have shown us, is that we should never expect Brexit, the election of Trump. A lot of people didn't expect that to happen, and it happened. And so I think we're always kind of prepared that anything can happen. But of course, it was a shock that it's come to this. It's extremely sad. And it's a mass production of grievances. It's a mass production of trauma. And I mean, in a global world, none of us are stronger than our weakest link. And what we are seeing now is that this war is affecting all of us. And I think for a lot of people, it's very important to also become aware that some of the people who will be hit hardest by this, apart from the Ukrainian and the people who are directly involved in this war, is the people in Sahel in Africa, who won't be able to afford food. It's going to be mass starvation. And so I think the global effects in a global world where we are all dependent on each other, this war is we have no idea how this is going to affect all of us on the long term. But I mean, for people, listeners in America, they will already know that they see the gas prices, you see the food prices. There are several things that are due to the pandemic, but now the war comes on top of this, and it's going to be tough economically for a lot of people.
Yes, and the corporations here are price gouging out like crazy, record profits. And they're kind of all these corporations are doing it and getting away with it because under the guise of inflation or the pandemic or supply chain issues, but the profits are like record profits, especially the oil companies. It's just insane. And that's the nature of capitalism, though. It's exploitive. And it's going to take advantage of situations to make more money. It's designed that way.
That's the tragedy, that it's always the ones who are already suffering who will be suffering even more. And so I think that we have to look at this crisis in Europe now on many, many levels, because you have the human suffering directly there on the ground. You know, now we are talking torture. People are being raped, and, it's terrible what's going on. And this was, as soon as the war broke out, we had several prominent people who have been working with torture and torture victims for years, who have been working with Rwanda, who have been working with the Balkans, especially the torture during the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. And then they also said that we have experience from Georgia. We know what Russia did in Georgia. So we are expecting mass torture. And of course, everyone knows Syria. the situation in Syria, what people have gone through there. I've interviewed several people from there, torture victims. They've explained what's been going on. And so, but what's shocking for me is that I did a lot of stories about torture victims around 2006, 7, 8, like after the Balkan Wars, how these scars, you know, especially raped women who are also being shut out from their families because of taboo and because of the terrible thing with the, that kind of torture is that you feel guilty yourself, which is this terrible effect of rape and torture. And we have all this knowledge, and I was making all these stories about torture victims and kind of hoping that torture was something of the past. And then to meet young people 10 years later who had been suffering severe torture. I met this young man called Umar. He went out in the streets during the Arab Revolution in Syria, hoping for change, hoping for democracy, just hoping to be able to speak freely. And he ended up in Assad's notorious, horrible prisons, and he almost died. He had tuberculosis. He weighed next to nothing. He was just skin and bones when they somehow managed to get him out, and he fled through Europe on a boat to Greece with his younger brother, who was 11 years old, and he was accompanying him on this journey because somebody had to accompany this young man because he was so ill. And they did this horrendous journey through Europe in 2015, when it was a completely different situation in Europe in regards to how we were treating the refugees. And they ended up in Sweden. And at this, he had to go to get some help with his eyes due to this tuberculosis. And at the waiting room, he met this family man who was sitting there with his daughter who had got a little pain in her eye. And it ended up with these two boys moving in with this Swedish family who took them in, who took them under their wing. And they ended up growing up there. And today he is a well-known man. And this is just a few years ago, and he's received even this medal from the Swedish king for young leadership. And he's now in the US. He's spoken to Congress several times, and he's using his voice. And he says that being tortured, being in that prison, is the best university I've ever been to. So there are so many ways people are dealing with these things. So, but it's hard for me to see that a young person experienced this after I did all those stories, hoping to stop it. And so I think that, as a young journalist, you know, you want to kind of save the world. It's a cliche, but you want to make a change. You want to make you want to strengthen democracy and make the world in which we live in a bit better for more people. And when you see it's going in the opposite direction, of course you get really sad.
Yeah, I wondered about that when I've read your coverage and seen stuff, and I was thinking about you. What was it like when you saw the children that were coming through the border? Because you're a mom of two, and children are children. I saw these pictures of kids with their little stuffed animals and their tears. I know you're a reporter and a professional, but how does it affect you as a mom, as a human being?
Well, that's the really striking thing, is that you also know that they have been separated from one of their parents, from the father. And in some cases, both of the parents have stayed to fight for their country. And they are fighting for all of us, in a sense. They are fighting for democratic values, for the Europe, which we know. And then you see these children who are carrying that burden and who have to now suddenly find a new life. And what's striking is also that on one border crossing in Slovakia. I had just been live in our evening news broadcast, and I went into this tent where I met people who had just crossed the border, and I met this mother and Anna and her daughter Victoria. And Anna, the mother, was showing me on social media the bombardment of her home city, and she was, you know, they are shaking, they are so stressed out. And this was just a few days after the war broke out as well, so everyone was in shock. And the daughter, she was sitting next to her, and she was holding the hands over her ears in order not to hear it. And so you see how the children are trying to cope. And there was also a different situation where I met this mother who had two boys, exact same age as my own kids. And these two kids, they came over to me and offered me some sweets. And I thought, wow. And so I children are children. I mean, they are just so natural in any setting. For them, life is life. Whatever you do, if you are there for them, that's, you know, you have to be the safe spot. And so I asked the mother if I could interview her and do just a little interview there on the border. And she said, I'd rather not, because I don't want to break down in front of my kids and make them even more worried than they already are. And so you see how the parents are trying to kind of hold up, you know, to stay this, a solid parent in front of the children, so that they won't see how scared you actually are, and that the world in which you were living and what you knew, it's all gone. And I mean, so that's shocking to see. But at the same time, when we have these politics and speed making it possible for people to help, it's amazing to see what's going on. I mean, how people are reaching out, opening their arms, opening their homes, really trying to help. So that was at the same time very comforting to see that this kind of response, and that the politicians have given people the chance to show that response. Because I met a lot of people in 2015 as well who wanted to help, but a lot of the things that they wanted to do back then was illegal. It was illegal to take refugees, to your home, just kind of like we've been seeing now. So I think that, so for me, it was, it's been very interesting to see the changes and how the politics are affecting the people on the ground so swiftly. And at the end also, I mean, when I was traveling home from covering the crisis from Poland and Slovakia, I was traveling together with a whole people fleeing. I mean, there were Ukrainians everywhere. And I mean, these are, when we were parking at hotels in the evening, I would park next to two cars with Ukrainian signs, you know, and in the morning when I had my breakfast, I would sit next to refugees from Ukraine. And in the reception at posh hotels, there would be information from the International Organization for Migration. It was really, really strange. And at the airport, I met several people fleeing. And there was this elderly couple, Led and Lydia, in their 70s, who had fled. And Led, he told me that although they had reached a Krakow, and they were there for a few nights before traveling on to Texas, where they had family, he said that whenever there was a car, like a police car or any other emergency vehicle out in the streets, he would just like rush up in the night and be ready to run down to the basement and seek shelter. So he was already traumatized, although he had probably just been maybe 10 days into the war, and then they had fled out of the country. And in the end, on my way home, I was getting off the plane in Oslo, and we have a lot of equipment, so we were almost the last ones to get off the plane. And there was this young woman standing there. She must have been the same age as me. And I thought, I saw her with a baby, and I said, "Do you need some help?" And she said yes, and I said, "Oh, I'm so glad you wanted to receive my help, because a lot of people will say no as well." And so she gave me her baby, and then I realized she had another kid as well, and it turned out to be a 5-year-old boy sleeping on the seat. And I know, as a mother myself, how difficult it is to get your kids off planes sleeping, and I could see that despair. And so I said, "Do you want me to carry him? I have kids myself." And she accepted. And so I ended up carrying these two children out of the plane while she was dealing with the luggage. And the thing was also, she didn't have much luggage, you know, they have just fled with the little they have. And you know, it could have been me.
Do you ever break down and just cry?
Not this time, actually. I am a person who is easily moved, but at the same time, there were so many people who were helping out. And although this is like, it's a war with such huge consequences that we don't know where it's going to end. But at the same time, there are so many things happening which are showing all the hope, and which are showing that democracy is still strong, people are still strong, the love is strong. And when people are being given the opportunity to show that love and to care for each other, they do. And I think that that made it, I've been more sad coming home from other areas where I feel like nobody cares. You know, I come home from, say, covering the war in southern Thailand, where people are being beheaded and children are being blown up at school, and nobody here even knows about it. And when I back in the days when I was a freelancer, I would contact, you know, editors and offer the story, and they would be like, "Well, it's not really a conflict that we care about." And I'm like, "Well, that's why I went there." That's why I wanted to cover it, you know? I mean, those things made me much, much more sad, you know, when people are being silenced, when they are not being given a voice. That's what really, that makes me down.
As a mother, are you concerned about the world and the way it will look for your children when they perhaps are 18 or 22, 24?
I think that children are very adaptable. So, you know, what you grow up in, that's natural to you if your parents are stable. But if you are growing up in unstable relationships, whether it's an unstable family or an unstable community, a neighborhood, or an unstable nation, or an unstable world, that may affect you. And what we've seen from the pandemic is that the restrictions we had here in Norway, where we had quite strict restrictions like you've had in the States as well, it's affected the youth in ways that the government maybe didn't kind of take into account in the beginning. You know, they had to make so many difficult decisions in such a short time, and it was a historic act of solidarity with the elderly and with the sick in the beginning, which we were all very happy to do. But we were at the same time worried, how will this affect the children and how will this affect the youth in some of the most formative years, you know, youngsters who are heading out into the world to find themselves, to find their identity, to figure out who they want to be. When they are being shut down into a small apartment, having to try to study, figure out, everything. I think it's such a hard blow for a young generation. So I'm not sure, but I had this talk for students up in Trondheim in Norway a few weeks back with this single project I did. And I said to them, at the same time, they've experienced something none of us had. They've actually been through something, and they've been given an experience that if they decide to try to make that experience into their strength, then maybe they will be better equipped for the years ahead than we maybe were. So I think there's always positive and challenging aspects to any generation and any development. And what's really important now to stress is that we are living in a democracy, and it doesn't come for free. We have to take care of our democracy if that's to survive in this world we are living in at the moment.
It's so true, and what a great take. And speaking of young people, you did a landmark series on, what is it, 30% of Norwegians are single and can't find a partner. Will you fill in the blanks for us and talk about why culturally and as a society turned into such a lonely place for so many people?
Well, the thing was that as a foreign affairs reporter, I was, I'm tracking a lot of trends around the globe. And after the choice of Brexit and Trump, we were kind of becoming aware of some demographic changes, of large amounts of people being single. And I mean, single can be great. It can be a fantastic life as a single. Many people are very happy being single. But through all this hate mail I'm getting, I was going into dialogue with a lot of these people, and I realized that they're also very lonely. And some of them who are very frustrated in the beginning are angry. When I get into a dialogue, I realize that they are really grieving. They are grieving that they are not living the life that they were expecting to be living. And so I thought, because we are living in a time where people are questioning truth and the facts are under fire. And I thought, we need the facts. So I asked my bosses, can I go from international relations to close relations and map out the demographic changes from the 1980s until today to see what's happened to society? Also because you were asking me about children and the future of the children. And, we have a lot of single parents. I was wondering, how is all this affecting society? Because we see that it's affecting the politics, how people vote. And of course, the decisions that the politicians are making is affecting a single people's life. One example is just the skyrocketing housing prices. It's really difficult to be single in this housing market. Now, so I asked, can I just go together with Statistics Norway and try to figure out the numbers? And so what we found, and this had never been done before, so they thought it was quite fun as well to get this challenge and try to figure out how can we map out approximately how many people who are single at the moment. And in 1981, there were it was about 23%, 24% of the Norwegian population were single. Now it's 33%. And the big change is in the younger age groups. And some of it is quite natural. We spend more time studying because we have a great system where the state will fund your higher education. Like when I moved to England to do my journalism degree, and when I moved to Spain to do my master in peace, it was all funded by the government and through government loans. So I've never had to ask my parents for anything. I could provide for myself from the age of 18. And so we have these possibilities, and we also have the fact that we've had equality for so long in Norway. We had our first female prime minister in 1981. And so the red carpet has been kind of rolled out from my generation, Generation X, where we had equality and we had the funds because we had found the oil, and the politicians wanted us, the people, to be the ones, getting opportunities due to this new richness. So we've been able to go out in the world to study, and then we want to spend some time getting a good job, and then we We might study a bit more, and then we want to get into the housing market. And you know, time's passing, and you do all these things. And I think for a lot of people as well, you want to make a good impression where you work. So you give everything to your job. You're working 24/7, also because it's so much fun. But then you suddenly realize, oh my God, time's ticking. What happened to finding the one, to meeting the one, to actually forming a family? Because most people come from a family, they've grown up in a family, whether it's divorced parents or not. You grew up somewhere and you kind of expect to kind of go in the same direction yourself. And what we've found through these numbers is that the younger groups, you have a lot of people who are involuntarily single and who are dreaming about becoming parents and who are not. They're not meeting the one and they are not becoming parents. And the big change since the 1980s is that women can seek assisted reproduction help. So they can go to, for example, Denmark and get donor help and become parents on their own. So we're also getting a lot of single mothers with children with just one parent. And so all these changes are affecting the society on several areas. And these are changes that are not so visible to everyone. So my other kind of headline for this story was all the sorrow we do not see, because a lot of people are grieving. They're actually grieving that they didn't get the life that they wanted, because when you approach your 40s and you still haven't met someone and you still haven't had those children, you're starting to feel that time's running out, although, you know, you never know what's going to happen. And then that, and on the other side, you have all the divorcees, and I'm very happy to say that it's no longer either a taboo to become divorced in Norway. I mean, some relationships are not meant to last, and for many people, you know, you find peace after going in separate directions. But the result is the same. It's always a grieving process, letting go. And when you, at the same time as you are going through this grieving process, are hitting the housing market, you're hitting all these high costs as a single parent, it can be really, really hard. And that also affects politics. So we're seeing how both national and international politics are affecting single people, and also how single people are voting and how they are affecting the political landscape. And I think that I mean, we've seen after Brexit in the UK, they've started this cross-parliamentary, like I think all parties are together on this board where they are talking about young boys and men's. What is it like to be a man and a young boy in the UK today? But I think you also have to ask the same question for women, because there are always it's often that we see kind of incels who are doing some attack. We've had a lot of terror attacks from so-called incels, you know, young involuntarily men who are living involuntarily celibacy.
Is it a combination of social media, the internet? Why are people choosing not to engage with each other and be in a relationship? I see it, it's epidemic in America too. Loneliness is like everywhere, and people being single. I'm single and I would love to be in a relationship, and I've actively dated and tried. And as you know, my plan is to come to Norway and see if I have any luck there, meet your friends.
You have to come, you're more than welcome. There are so many lovely, you know, now that you know that 33% of the population at the age above 18 are single, you should.
I feel like I finally have a chance now. You know, it's like I'm the old lion with the bad leg, and the only way he's going to catch anything is, you know, if the herd is just overly abundant, that even the old lion might be able to catch something. You know, the things are so bad, even he found somebody.
Yeah, but you know what you're saying is that, like, all the single people I'm talking to are saying the same. They are so, like, not everyone. Some, I have to stress that there are also very happily single people who are not who doesn't want to date anyone or to get into a relationship, but the majority, they do want a partner and they do want to experience love and have someone to share their life with. And so a lot of people are wondering, why is it so hard? Because with all the new technology, it should be easy. I mean, you can just dial or just send one little message and you can be talking to someone. But trying to figure out there, which is really, really interesting, is that, you know, you had the Facebook whistleblower, Frances Haugen, who were explaining the algorithms and the structures behind Facebook, how they are using different methods in order to create strong emotions. And her warning was that they were trying to trigger anger, because that would keep people active within the social media platform they were engaging. And with Tinder, for example, or some of these other matching dating apps, what the experts I've asked are saying is that now they are using artificial intelligence and all the data that the users are giving them, you know, they're using all that data combined with algorithms based on these psychological methods, which are basically that they give you so many choices that it's so hard to make a choice that you end up alone. You just end up scrolling and scrolling. And also with this psychological methods, you are more likely to give the app a new chance than the date, because there's always something better just around the corner, maybe. And so some of these kind of psychological tricks within these apps are not so visible for us, but they are there. And I think that as soon as we know how to use these tools, because it's a tool like any tool, but it's like, do you want to take the hammer and put that nail in the wall, or do you want to use that hammer and hit yourself in the head? Because you just have to figure out how to use those tools in order to achieve what you want to achieve. And for some people, they do find new partners online, but they are also talking about this new dating culture, which is kind of pick and choose, and it's me, you know, me, very individual. What's in it for me? Not what can I contribute with? What can I give to another person? How can I make someone else happy? How can I change someone else's life into something better? So I think it's also a part of our individualistic society, which we are seeing in so many different levels of society as well. So I don't know, but I think that with the single project, what was really interesting was that I decided to really tell five stories of grief and how these five people had come through it and how they had succeeded and how they were now dealing with the new situation in their lives, whether they had been divorced or whether they never met someone and decided to have a child on their own, or whether they were widowed. And after we published this story, just within a few hours, I had hundreds of emails from people who said, thank you. Finally, I feel that someone kind of sees who I am and what I'm dealing with and can understand. Because a lot of people, since you are alone, you think that you are the only one. But the thing is, this is the trend. This is the new, that's why we called it the new single Norway. This is normal. Being single is normal. And so you shouldn't feel alone, because you're all in it together. And so I'm hopeful. I think that the sooner we have more facts and the sooner we have more understanding of the society in which we live in, the democracy that we are all having to take care of if we wanted to survive, then we have much better chance of also reaching our goals. The more information we have, the more knowledge, the more chances of succeeding in what you want to achieve. So I think you should definitely make it over to Norway, Paul. and I'll give you the cultural codes so you will succeed.
Count me in. I will come on a podcaster's visa. It will be the special podcast visa. And luckily, my algorithms, they'll say, well, I hope you're not planning to stay too long. And I'll say, no, it's completely weather-based. Once the temperature falls below a certain point, I will automatically immigrate from the country, head south, ultimately ending up on the Mediterranean and perhaps in Thailand.
Well, I think you will be very, I think it's a big chance that a Norwegian woman will follow you on that journey, because when it's really dark and really cold here, it's not so pleasant for us either.
If this comes true, I will consider the podcast once and for all a true success. I know that we've had a lot of great guests, but if I could end up with my soulmate through this show, I will consider the podcast a rousing success.
I think you have to do a summer series and actually travel Europe.
Absolutely. That's the plan right now. And you're going to be godmother to our children. You won't have any duties, official duties. It'll be like you're a monarch.
It will be an honor.
It would be an honor. And I'll have to start brushing up on my Norwegian. I know we talked about it too before. I want to call this part one. I want to do a second show with you on what it's like to grow up and live and exist in a social democracy, because a lot of Americans and people in general are ignorant about, they always think of socialism and they'll point to Venezuela or the days of Chairman Mao in China, that's not even close, or, you know, or God only knows what, maybe some Marvel comic strip. But I always look to the Scandinavian countries, and the social democracies like Denmark too, is just really humankind, doing its best work, and the people are happiest and live longer and are more educated and you name it. And I think you would do us a great service if you can come back and fill us in on that, both personally and from your professional observations.
I'd love to. I think it's important as well, because often a lot of things are being lost in translation between our cultures and nations. So, and also because a lot of the trends, you know, from the US hit us, but we always have to translate them into our local situation, our local culture, history. And so I think it's important to try to learn more about each other in order to kind of also to try to form a better future in the place in which we live. So, because, I mean, for Norwegian to be witnessing America at the moment, the US, which we care so deeply about. I mean, you've been on the forefront for so much change and so much progress, and now we're seeing, you know, you're being torn apart by some strange debates and I wish you could start listening to each other again. And after having, you know, figured out this single Norway, you know, I'm like, oh, I wish we could have some more opposites attract. You know, we need to talk to each other, and we need to talk to those that we don't understand, because it's only by talking to them and through open and curious dialogue without being afraid of being cancelled or whatever, that we really can understand each other and understand where the suffering is coming from and how we can reach out for compromise, because any democracy is compromise. And compromise is sacrifice, but compromise is also love of the other. So I think that I would be happy to talk about how we're trying here in Norway. I mean, it's all work in progress. And nobody's perfect. So we have a lot to learn from each other.
Yeah. You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.